This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is what more than 100 years of dieting can teach us. The story of Peter Pan starts, all of this has happened before and will all happen again. Barry could have applied the same intro to the more than 100 years of diet insanity in the United States. Previous diet ideas keep resurfacing like moles in an arcade whack-a-mole game. Knowing the history and context of this insanity gives us perspective and helps us be wiser in making sense of diet and weight loss advice. Susan Yeager has chronicled the madness with balance, humor, and perspective in her delightful book, The 100-Year Diet. Susan, welcome.
Well, hi, Michael. Great to be here.
The 100-year diet isn't some dull academic chronicle, but it's for the layperson, and it's focused on what's interesting and what's important. Take us back to the origins of the diet gurus, the cholera epidemic of the 1850s.
Well, the cholera epidemic, which actually was the first major epidemic to hit America when it was a new country, was in 1832. It crossed the ocean from England and from India and from France. And of course, it wasn't yet known that cholera comes from a little comma-shaped bacterium. And sadly, as we know, it still has an impact on impoverished nations of the world that can't get clean food and clean water. Well, in 1832, along comes a Presbyterian minister and Whole Foods advocate, Sylvester Graham, and he says that the cholera epidemic can indeed be reversed by diet, and recommends a vegetarian, condiment-free, spice-free diet to do this. This indeed did have some impact. He also recommends boiling water before you use it. He had a lot of terrific ideas, well before their time, in a sense, and people indeed started to follow what Graham said, and they began to feel better. And they did find that they would not get cholera if they firstly boiled their water. Of course, that was of great help. But also, very possibly, you know, in those days before refrigeration, meat probably was putrefied. And before FDA regulations, anything could be dumped on meat or vegetables, or if they weren't fresh, to make people think they were fresh and still buy them. So Graham actually got good results, and people started to follow him and follow him with great passion. There were Graham boarding houses. College students said, "We only want Graham-type food." He became wildly popular as a lecturer and as one of our first health food advocates, known today, of course, for Graham crackers.
The Graham crackers were designed to be bland.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely so. Graham did not like... Oh, he didn't like bread for a variety of reasons. Firstly, he felt that people should bake their own bread. White flour was starting to appear, and he knew instinctively, realized that nothing is known yet about carbohydrates or fats or protein, let alone, those are the macronutrients, let alone the micronutrients. But he instinctively knew that you should not be throwing the bran away from the flour. He hated the white flour and the mass-produced bread that he saw being manufactured and the flour that he saw being sold. And so he created this Graham cracker from very whole wheat, nutritious flour. It's not what you would get in the supermarket today.
No, the supermarket today, we put cinnamon and sugar on it.
Yeah, right. And I mean, you know, you look at those lists of additives, and this would be exactly, I mean, just the antithesis of Graham.
A lot of his advice was very good and somewhat like the whole food movement that we're seeing today, but he also was trying to dull appetites, both culinary appetites and sexual appetites.
That's true. He tied the two together. Bear in mind that Graham was not advocating weight loss. We were hardly a country that needed to lose weight. We were quite a thin country. I mean, no automobiles, plenty of manual labor, most people still farming. We were a very thin country. So this had really nothing to do with weight loss. It just evolved into that over the coming decades. But yes, absolutely, Graham believed that a spicy diet, one with spices and meats and plenty of condiments, would also increase sexual appetite. And being a Presbyterian minister and very fundamentalist in his religious beliefs, that was certainly one of the reasons for his diet. His diet was for lust control, really, as much as it was for health.
So, no alcohol, no sex, not even masturbation, and no caffeine.
That's true. You have to realize that masturbation, Graham, and then later picked up by Ellen Harmon White, the founder of the Seventh-day Adventists, and inadvertently had great impact on weight loss in America. Ellen Harmon White and her husband as Adventists believed that self-pleasuring was actually punishable by death.
Hmm. And I remember one of my first jobs back in the 60s, a summer job, was at a Seventh-day Adventist psychiatric hospital, and boy, it was soy and sanka.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, the Adventist, Ellen Harmon White, was greatly influenced by Graham. And here she and her husband are starting a new religion, the Adventists, and they take Graham's diet for their religion. And again, it is a vegetarian, spice-free, condiment-free, no coffee, no tea, no alcohol diet. So it's healthy. It's lots of fresh vegetables and lots of whole grains, but it's very bland.
Where did John Harvey Kellogg come in?
Well, John Harvey Kellogg was the disciple of Ellen Harmon White. So you can see the direct line here. John Harvey Kellogg was raised and mentored by White, not raised by White, raised by his parents, but along with White, and mentored by her to become the first head of her sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan. John Harvey was a brilliant man. He was a physician, a prolific writer, inventor of new uses for foods, along with his wife, Ella Harmon White. Everyone knows Kellogg's cornflakes, but John Harvey Kellogg also developed a lot of the soy, what we call meat substitutes sometimes today. He was one of the first people, maybe the first, to take soy and use it in that way. But what happened was, so here he is, the head of the sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, Ellen Harmon's White Sanitarium. And what's happening is people are going there, and unintended consequence is they're losing weight. Now, of course, we know today, of course, they're losing weight. They're having a vegetarian, very bland diet, probably not eating even all that much of the food that's offered to them, but eating very differently than the way they would eat at home, no alcohol as well. And the very rich and famous started to go to his sanitarium with an unintended consequence. And then ultimately, rumor, you know, had it that people went there to lose weight. John D. Rockefeller, Thomas Alva Edison, Henry Ford, they all went to the Battle Creek Sanitarium to lose weight. But John Harvey was a scientist and a very ethical and moral man, and he didn't know really why this was all working. He suspected why it was working, but it wasn't until 1894 when probably the most important name in diet and in nutrition in America, Wilbur Olin Atwater, first head of the USDA, a chemist, professor of chemistry at Connecticut Wesleyan University. Wilbur Olin Atwater went to Europe, very inquiring mind, inquisitive mind, and he went to the laboratories of the great dietitians, people like Carl von Voigt, people that were starting to segment out macronutrients, carbohydrates, fats, and protein. He went to their laboratories, and he came back to America, and he got a grant for $10,000, and that's a fortune, mm-hmm. You have to realize, Michael. I mean, the average worker made $500 a year, and he got a grant for $10,000 to build a calorimeter, and he did. And along with students and physicists, he meticulously burned. Maybe I should explain what a calorimeter is. It is something that burns the energy in foods and shows us how many calories are in a pound or an ounce, whatever quantity is being, you know, meticulously measured in that food. And he published his Farmer's Bulletin in 1894, giving a list of calories in all the foods that people were eating. Now, it's a quaint kind of list to read now because people, of course, were eating food. You know, there was no processed food. the only things on his list are apples or potatoes or certain cuts of meat or certain types of poultry. But calories were quantified. And now that enabled someone like John Harvey Kellogg to really put people on weight loss diets that would work. It enabled him to cut people's calories.
So we've only known about calories for a little over 100 years.
And they only became really important to Americans in, I would say, 1917. I mean, you could just draw a line and say, okay, after 1917, everything changed.
Because?
Because we entered the First World War. And Herbert Hoover, who would later become 31st President of the United States, Hoover was made the food czar. He was put in charge of getting food to our troops and to our allies overseas. Now, Hoover, being an engineer, he loved Atwater's booklet. He now knew how to pack as much energy, as many calories, as he could into a container. So all over, posted on walls, in magazines, in newspapers, Americans were told what to eat less of. And it was eat less, big bold letters, eat less, meat, wheat, sugar, and fat. America was put on a diet. Before 1917, if you weighed a little too much, it really wasn't particularly held against you. Taft, who became president of the United States in 1913, weighed 330 pounds. Imagine that today. I don't think it could happen. Big stars were heavy people. If a woman was voluptuous, it was thought she was kind of sexy, and she could easily have children, and that was good wife material. A man was affluent, so he was good husband material. But in 1917, that all turned around, and suddenly it was a disgrace to be fat. You were a traitor if you were fat, and you were ridiculed for it.
And part of this was that you weren't supporting the war effort?
You were not supporting the war effort.
You were eating more than your share.
You were eating too much. You were eating too much, and you were taking calories out of the mouths of our fighting troops overseas.
Wow.
It is no coincidence that at the same time, a woman, Dr. Lulu Hunt Peters, wrote the first best-selling diet book in the history of America. It was called Diet and Health with a Key to Calories. She dedicated the book to who else? Herbert Hoover, her hero. And she taught Americans, taking Atwater's charts, how to lose weight. And America really went on a diet in the 20s, and it really all caught up with America in the 30s.
How did it catch up with us?
Well, I have to tell you, Michael, that this was, to me, when I was researching this book, and I researched it for 7 years, I mean, I thought that if anything, there would be kind of a weight loss moratorium in the 30s. Here's the greatest depression the country has ever known. 25% unemployment, people on bread lines, people at soup kitchens. I thought, who in the world would care about dieting, about weight loss? How could that be? And yet, there were so many really, I don't know, I'd have to say goofy or loopy weight loss diets that became popular at that time. It would be difficult to look at a piece of ephemera at a magazine or a newspaper from the 30s without seeing some type of bizarre diet, like, oh, for example, the Hollywood 18-day diet. That was for 18 days, you ate only 585 calories a day of oranges and grapefruits, Melba toast, and one hard-boiled egg. 585 calories a day. That's less than a prisoner of war would get. And yet this was very popular. Bananas and skim milk, another very, very popular diet. 4 bananas, 4 glasses of skim milk. That's about 800 calories. Again, a starvation diet. What did all of these diets do? Of course, they set people up to lose weight. You starve yourself, you'll lose weight without any question. And then the minute you go off the diet, you gain it back. So it's kind of setting people up to fail. Not terribly awful a thing to happen in the 30s in that we were not yet a heavy country. So when people were trying to lose weight, they were trying to lose 5 pounds. And I can only theorize that the reason that these these really crazy diets, you know, pineapples and lamb chops, apples and only apples, chew a head of lettuce before every meal, you know, these crazy ideas. I think they were proliferating because people felt so out of control. And I think when you feel very out of control, it's good to be in control of something, you know, even if it's just what you have for lunch.
Well, today we have the same thing with the magazines touting the diet of the month, and it's often extreme grapefruit and kind of things. I wonder if that means that we're feeling out of control.
I don't know. I theorized when my book came out in May, I was doing, well, quite a number of radio shows and a lot of NPR-type shows. And at that same time, of course, the recession seemed probably even more dire than it does perhaps today. I don't know, fingers crossed. And yes, May and June and July of this year, we were seeing so many, you know, master cleanse, these really, really silly and possibly harmful diet plans proliferate again. And yeah, it well could be.
So what's the next chapter in the diet insanity?
The next chapter. Well, I think perhaps before we look to the next chapter, we should quickly take a look back, but not very far back, because we should maybe take a look at the 1980s, I should say, when America really started to need to be on a diet. Because bear in mind, we had all of these diets, you know, and we can name them all, the Atkins and the Ornish and Pritikin, which, by the way, Ornish and Pritikin are pretty good ways of eating, but Atkins and Ornish and Pritikin and Herman Taller and Tarnow, all these diets. And all of them were kind of meaningless to the country on the whole because we were in a heavy country. We were a thin country in pretty good shape. This is in spite of, you know, fast food restaurants proliferating in the 50s and 60s and the suburbs and people driving and televisions and, you know, all of the things that we think. It didn't really all catch up to us until the 1980s. And that was when our food supply started to get so out of control. In the 1980s, scientists looked at figures and they said, what is going on here? You know, Americans were always about 20-25% obese and overweight combined. What is going on here? Suddenly it's jumped to 33%. And they thought, this is terrible. And they started tracking it every year. Well, every year it increased. It has been going uphill since the mid-80s. And we are now at a point where 70% of us are obese or overweight.
70%?
So the first question and the important question is, how do we reverse that? And that's not going to happen until we start looking at food differently in this country. We currently have 700 more calories available per capita than we need. Now, in the 1980s, when this started to happen, there were about 300 more calories available than we needed. Before that, there weren't. We had the amount of calories per capita that we needed, and that's why our weight remained, and I'm talking about our weight as a country, not individually, our weight remained stable. But once corn and soy and wheat became subsidized, once high fructose corn syrup got into, you know, all of our food, once carbonated beverages, sweetened sodas, went from 6 ounces and 12 ounces to 32 ounces or 64 ounces for a serving, that's when things started getting out of control. And what the future has to be is that we, each of us, have to take back control of our own personal food system.
So 1980s, the quality of the food started going down and being more fattening and harmful. And I know you really dislike diets, and you're saying what we need to focus on is improving the quality of the food we eat, and a lot of the weight loss will take care of itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't like diets, and I should maybe say why. I think that some people who are in need of losing weight, some things can be helpful. I mean, Weight Watchers give some good advice, and people who need support groups, maybe. I mean, Weight Watchers is helpful for people, as is TOPS, Take Off Pounds Sensibly, and Overeaters Anonymous. I mean, these are other support groups and perhaps a little bit less expensive than attending Weight Watchers, but they're all good. And I mentioned earlier diets devised by people like Dean Ornish. Very healthy diet, Dean Ornish's diet. Mm-hmm. And I don't see any problem with it, except that a lot of people have a difficult time staying on an Ornish or a Pritikin-type diet, because Americans, you know, Westerners in general, we don't have a very low-fat diet. And their diets are very, very low-fat. It's difficult for us. Even if you have a big, wonderful green salad, you're going to want to put some dressing on it, you know, and that's olive oil and that's some fat. So it's a hard diet for people to stay on. But for people that like eating that way, it's a terrific way to eat and probably will extend longevity, you know, extend life. I think you might agree with that, Michael.
Yeah, well, Dean Ornish is a wonderful example. He, 20 years ago, presented very good data that his diet actually reversed heart disease in people with advanced heart disease. I mean, what more could we ask for? But not only did he have a very strict diet, but he also insisted that his people learn stress management, mm-hmm. they meditate, that they exercise, and it's hard to get Americans to do all those things.
Exactly, and that's the problem. There's nothing negative to be said about Ornish. He gives wonderful advice, but people don't tend to do it. It was the same. Nathan Pritikin, who was not a physician, was an inventor. But his advice was equally superb, but it's difficult to get people to do. And that, if you're going to go on a diet, however, to go on one that will, you know, kind of first do no harm, like an Ornish diet, would certainly be the way to go. Just about every other diet is going to harm in some way, even if it's not getting the body the correct number of nutrients that it needs to thrive. But apart from that, my dislike of diets is that I do believe that the majority of them set people up to fail, because it's very difficult, of course, to stay on a starvation diet. Who can and who should? But even apart from that, the low-carb type diets. Now, you can cut carbohydrates out of your menu plan. There are only three macronutrients, proteins, fats, and carbohydrates. Take away one, of course you're going to lose weight. You're taking away one third of the three macronutrients, but you're not going to stay on it for that long. Most people don't want to live without rice or potatoes or bread or pasta, and why should they? These are all good foods that have cultures have thrived on these foods. Rice, Japan, Asian cultures have thrived on diets based on rice for millennia. And you know what? I mean, Japan is the thinnest country in the world, the least rate of obesity in the world, and along with that, the lowest rate of heart disease, the lowest rate of stroke, the lowest rate of the cancers measured by the OECD, let's say, and the longest lived people in the world. So who could, you know, possibly say cut rice out of your diet, you know, and think this is a sensible plan? What happens with all of these diets is they set people up to fail. And I really think that you fail once, you feel badly about yourself, you kind of fall off the diet wagon, you go back to eating the old way you used to eat because you haven't learned any new way to eat. You haven't learned how to eat correctly. And then you gain the weight back and you go on another diet and you fail again. And eventually apathy can set in. And I do think that along with the high fructose corn syrup, along with the cheap, bad food that has been, you know, filling our supermarkets, certainly for the past 20 or 30 years, along with that, I think that apathy has set in for a lot of people when it comes to losing weight. I've heard this myself. I've had people say to me, Susan, I just give up. I can't lose weight no matter what I do. And, of course, they've just gone off some other whatever, Atkins diet or whatever they may have just gone off of. They say, I can't lose weight no matter what I do, and so life is too short, and I'm just going to eat whatever I want.
Well, if their approach is just finding another diet, the apathy might actually be a good thing in that every time they try one of these extreme diets, they tend to reset their metabolism at a lower level and just make it more uphill.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. So every time it gets just a little bit more difficult is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wish there were a spin-off word from diet in that it covers both going on a diet and also describing what you eat. Are you aware of a good word that talks about good food principles and good eating principles without using the four-letter word?
No, I'm not, and that's a good point. We need another word for eating badly, I think. The French have this word, malbouffe, and what they mean by malbouffe, it would translate, I guess, as bad for the mouth, but what they mean by that is not just junk food. They mean eating badly, eating too much, not stopping when you're full, you know, or eating between meals. And that's a terrific word. And of course, the French don't have an obesity problem because, again, the French, right? When you look at the cultures that really respect their food,
mm-hmm.
you don't find obesity.
And that's what came to mind when you were describing the Japanese. I think we have the word in the U.S., and that's gluttony.
Gluttony, yeah. Yeah. I mean, in part gluttony, in part, you know, I'm not in any way saying that people aren't responsible for what they do, because I think we all are, and we all have to take responsibility, and if we have eaten too much, we have to take responsibility for that and do something differently. But I also think that in a sense we were blindsided in America, because all of these subsidized foods, the corn, the soy,
mm-hmm.
the wheat, that goes into, of course, let's just look at corn, high fructose corn syrup. It also goes into feed for cattle, which is what produces all of that cheap beef. The genetically modified food, the corn and the soy, which France won't accept, Italy won't accept, Japan won't accept. America tends to be a culture, for right or wrong, far more about business and about profits. And so, in a way, this kind of all got away from us. Between 1990 and 2005, retail space doubled in the United States. Now think about that, because in part it doubled to house all of these extra calories. These 700 extra calories per capita, they've got to go somewhere. So retail space doubled. Why? Because one can't walk into a mass merchant anymore without finding it's not just a department store. There's a supermarket in there.
Mm-hmm.
A Target, a Walmart, a Kmart. There are supermarkets, but mainly supermarkets that are selling bad food. Food with trans fatty acids, foods with high fructose corn syrup, all of the bad stuff. Same thing with drugstores. Hard to walk into a drugstore anymore in New York City that isn't also a supermarket.
In addition to us liking the profit motive and our food supply having gotten corrupted by that, I think we also have a love affair with technology, and we mm-hmm. want new things, you know, new, better, improved.
We love technology. We are all strangely able to accept pseudoscience and embrace it almost, you know, as much as we do science. And that, to me, is an odd thing, too. When you read some of these, quote, diet books, unquote, you look at the, quote, evidence they give.
Mm.
For what they're saying, and it's really non-existent. As you know, as a scientist, you can find anything to back up anything. If it's a study with two subjects or four subjects and it's never been duplicated, and that's the kind of evidence, if any, indeed any evidence is used. I mean, we have, quote, diet books written by movie stars and celebrities and people that know, you know, not nutritionists and not doctors and no background whatsoever, and that's embraced as well. So it's this willingness to, and it's kind of a naivete to accept anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I once had someone sit next to me at a dinner party tell me that she had found the secret of losing weight and it was never eating onions. I mean, how do you answer something like that?
I'm very interested in centenarians, and when they ask them their secret, you get the most bizarre stuff. I mean, you know, broccoli and red wine. There's one woman in the Philippines that said it was eating raw termite eggs that led to her longevity.
Well, you know, maybe there's something.
anything to that. I don't know.
There could indeed be, you know, antioxidants and anti-carcinogenics in certain foods. I mean, we certainly are beginning to realize that some foods are far more protective than others. As you say, like cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and maybe resveratrol and red wine, although from what I read, you'd have to be awful drunk
to get a benefit from that.
Yeah.
We're talking with Susan Yeager, author of The 100-Year Diet. The website is thehundredyeardiet.com. Susan, I know you've written about sexual health before. How did you choose to spend 7 years of your life researching this?
Oh, well, my master's degree is in nutrition and food studies. I went back to school kind of late in life to get a master's degree. I had been a businesswoman. I'm also an adjunct professor at NYU in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health. So I also blog for Huffington Post on a very regular basis about food and diet and health. It's pretty much what I do, although I'm interested in all areas of health. I came to write this book, really, how the idea came to me was because my husband and I have a house on out on the east end of Long Island. I'm not sure, you know, I realize your listeners are all over the country, but that's about 100 miles outside of New York City. And on a late summer, we go there on the weekends. And on a late summer weekend, I had invited family and friends over for dinner. Now, this is about 7 years ago. And one of them was a vegan, and so I prepared a vegan meal, you know, and I thought it was a pretty nice, I'm a very enthusiastic home cook, and I prepared a roasted eggplant and tomato and basil casserole, and I was chopping some wonderful local garlic and tossing it with fresh herbs, planning to toss that with pasta and olive oil, and I had a big green local salad fresh picked from a garden, and, you know, I thought I had everything really nicely under control, and my aunt and uncle show up, and they say, "What's for dinner?" I tell them, and my aunt looks crestfallen, and she says, "But there's nothing we can eat, not a single thing." And I say, "Why not?" And she replies, "We're on Atkins." And I said, "Well, why didn't you tell me, you know? I mean, why didn't you call and tell me you were on Atkins?" Now, this is 2003, and she replies, "Everyone's on Atkins." And, you know, in 2003, she wasn't half wrong. You couldn't go to a supermarket without seeing low-carb, you know, piled to the ceiling, low-carb pasta and bread and crackers and cookies. Everything was low-carb. So what could I do? You know, I ran to the local market. I got the last two organic free-range chickens, and I run back and quarter some lemons and rub them with olive oil and garlic and spices and throw them on the grill, open wine, and about an hour and a half later, we have dinner. And, you know, the Atkinsites ate the chicken, and the vegan ate all of the vegan dishes, and everyone else ate everything in sight. And it was fine, and I forgot about it until the next day, when in late afternoon, I'm back in the kitchen, and the phone rings, and it's my friend John. And he says to me, "I'm going on a new diet." And I say, "What's that?" And he says, "I'm going to eat right from my blood type."
Uh-huh.
And
I
say, "John, what are you talking about?" And he says, "Well," he said, "if you're one type, you're like a type A, you eat a certain way, maybe you eat all meat. And if you're a type O, you eat a certain way, maybe you eat all vegetables." And I say, "John, this makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. I mean, there are only four blood types, and most people happen to be A or O. Why would this cause you to lose weight?" And he says, "I have no idea, but it has to be better than Atkins." So that's when I started thinking about this paradox. My aunt has published 5 books. My uncle is a psychoanalyst. My friend John is an artist and, frankly, one of the smartest people I know. And I started thinking, what's going on here? Why are these really smart people following these foolish diets? Why are they willing to have this suspension of disbelief? And I realized I wasn't free of it either. I had been on some loopy diets in my life. And so I started to research it. And as I started to research it, I just became more and more fascinated in not only weight loss in America, but in how our food systems change. One of the things, as I said before, I didn't expect was the fad dieting in the 30s, but the other thing I really didn't realize was how we were dieting way before we had to. It was, I guess you would call it, a solution looking for a problem. Until the 1980s and 1990s, when we did start to become way overweight and we really needed all of these diets. Before that, it was just people trying to cash in on a non-issue.
Just for fun, let's talk about some of the wilder gurus. The one with the blood type, what was his background?
He is, I believe, a naturopath. He calls himself a naturopath, and I think he does have a PhD in that field from a non-accredited university. You would be amazed how many non-accredited universities you find among these, quote, gurus.
Mm-hmm.
And some, by the way, very excellent educational backgrounds. Interestingly enough, I was curious about where he got this evidence from, and does give some sources in his original Eat Right for Your Blood Type. But if you actually pull the abstracts and pull the studies, you'll see it was what I was discussing earlier. There was a study in China, and I'm going back here, I'm remembering here from a number of years ago, so I may not be exact in what I'm saying, but there was a study done in China on cancer and certain vitamins, finding that certain parts, segments of the population were more likely to develop stomach cancer if they had certain blood types. That was one of the studies he used, but of course this is from a long time ago. It was from subjects, maybe 8 of them in the entire study. The study was never duplicated. In other words, it's not evidence-based proof. That was the only even grain of something you might call evidence-based proof, though, in the blood type diet. Think about it. There are numerous antigens in the blood, type being just one of them. To think that this is going to in any way affect what you should or shouldn't eat is folly, or you can get really a best-selling book.
So a number of the gurus would take one obscure study and use that as the basis. I remember Harvey and Marilyn Diamond, Fit for Life.
Oh my God.
Tony Robbins was really pushing it. Tell us about them.
Well, Harvey and Marilyn Diamond, another good example. Harvey Diamond called himself Doctor. I think he put PhD after his name. He went to a non-accredited mail order school that was ultimately was shut down. The government actually shut the school down and did not allow it to give any more degrees. It was just send in your money and get a degree type of school. And their thesis was not to combine foods. In other words, don't eat proteins and carbohydrates the same meal. Somehow, I guess, ignoring the fact that almost all foods are a combination of protein, carbohydrate, and fat. You know, that's how it works. And only to eat fruit at a certain time of day because your body digests fruit in the morning but not in the afternoon. You know, just really bizarre and insane concepts. And, again, that turned into a best-selling book.
For years and
there
years.
There was a very, very cute piece that Jane Brody, the health writer for the New York Times, wrote about them. A physician, a real physician, one that went to an accredited university, sent in to this school, this nutrition school, information about Sassafras Herbert. And Sassafras Herbert became listed as a nutritionist. In fact, Sassafras Herbert went into the who's who of top nutritionists in America, according to the school that the Diamonds went to. And Sassafras Herbert, the only thing is, was a poodle. This physician sent in his poodle's name. He sent the check. You know, Sassafras Herbert, as it turned out, wasn't the only animal to graduate from that school. A number of people did this. I would say to all of your listeners, if they want help with nutrition and if they want help with their diet for whatever reason, illness, or to try to lose some weight or for whatever reason, to really be careful about the credentials of that nutritionist. Make sure that the nutritionist went to an accredited university and doesn't just have letters after their name. Make sure where those letters come from.
And we have to be careful about Sassafras' book, Eat Like a Dog. It's possible for a guru to give good advice and not follow it himself. Was that the case with the Berger Immune Power Diet, where at age 40 he was 365 pounds?
Yikes. You know, I don't know what the psychology of that man is or was. He was a terrible drug abuser as well. He died of both overweight and drug abuse, cocaine abuse. I have to think that he graduated from Tufts University Medical School, so, you know, very, very fine school. I have to think that when he wrote, he was really capitalizing with this immune diet idea. He just wanted to make a lot of money, and, you know, AIDS had just become a very, very important thing discussed in the country. It was just coming out all about AIDS, and people were very, very nervous about this, rightly so, and it was a disease of the immune system. So I think he just thought, well, here's a great idea for a money-making scheme. I'm going to combine weight loss, who isn't interested in that, with strong immunity issues, who isn't interested in that these days. And he created a best-selling book. And, yeah, absolutely, you're right. I mean, he clearly did not pay any heed himself to anything he said.
We'll get back to Susan Yeager in just a moment. Remember Susan Yeager talking about the radical shift in American agriculture to more corn, soybeans, wheat, and corn syrup? That caused the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 fatty acids to shift from about a ratio of 1 to 2 to a ratio of 1 to 50. The result is inflammation, a key contributor to cardiovascular disease and most chronic diseases, including diabetes, arthritis, and cancer. The solution is healthier eating, olive oil rather than vegetable oils, and fish. If you don't eat a lot of fish, the next best thing is a fish oil supplement. With aspirin and some vitamins and supplements, house brands are as good as brand names. Fish oil, however, is one supplement you want to go for quality because fish, especially fish high in omega-3 fatty acids, also have mercury, heavy metals, and PCBs. The world's expert on fish oil is Dr. Barry Sears. His OmegaRX is the gold standard for fish oil. It goes through two refining processes to remove the heavy metals and PCBs, and I believe it's the only one in the world to test every single batch. It's the best, safest, most potent fish oil available anywhere. If you care about your health and are concerned about the quality of your life as you age, you should be taking Zone Labs OmegaRX fish oil on a daily basis. To order, go to zonediet.com or call 1-800-404-8171. Use the promo code AGELESS, A-G-E-L-E-S-S, and you'll receive a 10% discount on your first order. That's zonediet.com or 1-800-404-8171. Order now. You only get one body. Take good care of it with OmegaRX fish oil at zonediet.com. And now back to Susan Yeager. And then Atkins lived to 72, which is a good age, but when he died, he was 258 pounds and died of a heart attack and high blood pressure?
Yeah, well, no one's really sure about that. Atkins indeed was overweight and indeed had a heart condition. That is true. After he died, however, he died of either a heart attack or a stroke or a slip on the ice. No one could know because the body was immediately cremated. That's probably because it would have been terrible for the Atkins franchise if it had been proven that he died of a heart attack. But it's interesting to contrast Atkins with Nathan Pritikin. Pritikin put in his will, when I die, I want an autopsy to be performed, and I want the results, good or bad, to be published in JAMA, in Journal of American Medical Association. And indeed, that was done, and it was said that Pritikin had the arteries of a 30-year-old man. His heart was in perfect shape. He had a rare type of incurable leukemia. That's how he died. It, you know, diet unfortunately cannot help him there, or maybe it did. It may have kept him alive for many years longer than he would have lived otherwise. But there was a guy who really walked the talk. He said, look, do an autopsy, show people what my diet can do for their heart and for their artery.
I want to go back and just mention a few interesting parts of history. 1942, we had the Metropolitan Charts, and they were religiously followed, but you said they're very unscientific.
Well, yeah. If you think about those charts, it was all they had at the time, but it's based on people that get insurance. So we are talking about generally a more affluent population. And then, just very hard to figure out. I mean, you know, you have to decide if you have a small frame or a medium frame or a large frame. Who in the world knows what frame they have? And they give you some ways to figure that out, but no one ever really looked into it or read it. And then, you know, it's with 2-inch heels and fully dressed but without a coat. It's just a very, very difficult and convoluted way to figure out if your weight is optimal or not. And they change constantly as well because they were based on longevity. And, you know, life insurance charts, they're interested in getting people to live as long as possible so they pay out as little as possible. So the figures would change on a regular basis as well. I mean, that shifted over to body mass index, which is pretty much what's used today. Body mass index, by the way, is not necessarily the most reliable way to measure either, but it's, you know, probably better than the MetLife charts.
Right, and it isn't good at taking into account frame, bone density.
Well, yeah, I mean, body mass index is based on height and weight, but it's used really to measure populations, not individuals. So it is possible for, as you know, the ideal weight, your ideal weight would be a body mass index, a BMI between 20 and 25, and anyone can just Google body mass index and then plug in your height and your weight, and you will get your body mass index. If it's between 20 and 25, this is based on the World Health Organization stats, WHO, between 20 and 25, you are, you know, in good shape. You are of normal weight. 25 to 30, you would be deemed overweight. And above 30, you would be considered obese. The one problem with body mass index is that on an individual basis, you can well have a BMI of 26 or 27. This happens with men a lot who work out, who are really in very good shape. But their BMI comes out at 26 or 27, not 25 or 24. These men would not really be considered overweight. And certainly if they eat a healthy diet and they're exercising and they have a BMI of 26 or 27, man or woman, that is not going to have a negative impact on your health. So that's the only little caveat with BMI. It can be a bit deceiving until you get to 30. I mean, anyone with a BMI above 30, once obesity sets in, diabetes and heart disease and stroke and various cancers, I mean, and you know, medical conditions prevail.
Another fascinating thing you mentioned was that around the time of Jane Fonda, we went from weight consciousness to shape consciousness.
Yeah, it seemed to be that this brief shift that was in the early 80s, but took hold for a while. I mean, it was the main reason people said they were buying VCRs, you know, to do workout tapes, and maybe they did it once or twice and then put them on the shelf and never did it again, because it certainly didn't seem to have any lasting impact.
Well, I think it did in, if you remember the Saturday Night Live character Fernando, you know, it's better to look marvelous than to...
Right, better to look good than to feel good, yeah.
So where are we now in this country? We've got the Biggest Loser program on TV that kind of epitomizes go on a diet.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there are any studies being done yet tracking those Biggest Losers and seeing how many of them keep the weight off. I think there are some. Where are we now? Well, we're not in very good shape, are we? I mean, not with nearly 70% of adult Americans obese or overweight, and not with 35% of our children obese or overweight. And not with the latest global figures. We're, again, number one, you know, the fattest country in the world. So we're not in very good shape right now. I mean, I can only hope that, you know, we have a president and first lady in the White House now. I mean, our first lady seems to be very concerned with improving school lunches and with teaching our children how to eat well, and that's a very good thing. I mean, it's got to start with the children. We've got to get phys ed back into the schools. We've got to get people cooking again. One of our biggest problems is that we don't cook. And once you stop cooking, you stop taking control over your body and over what you eat and what you put into it. But is this going to happen? I don't know. It needs funding. You know, you need tax dollars for that. And yet something comes along like a soda tax, and you hear people opposed to it. And I, for one, cannot imagine why. I mean, people aren't opposed to a tax on, well, they were opposed to a tax on tobacco, of course, but now it's an accepted thing. And people didn't stop smoking until we started taxing cigarettes. The Surgeon General report came out, and everyone said, oh, dear, cigarettes are terrible for us. They're terrible for your health, and you're going to die if you smoke. But no one stopped smoking. We didn't stop smoking until cigarettes began to be heavily taxed. There are certain taxes that really are a win-win situation for everybody. That was one of them.
Well, I think some of the objection is nobody likes to be told what to do or what they can't do, but also
that
this could be a very slippery slope.
I know. That is a problem, but we do have, quote, sin taxes already, don't we, on alcohol and mm-hmm. cigarettes.
The better researchers seem to be focusing on Mediterranean diet as one of the healthiest ways to eat. And if we view that as eating principles rather than measuring portions and that kind of thing, is that the healthiest direction to go?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. The Mediterranean diet actually came about in the 1950s, Ansel and Margaret Keyes. Ansel Keyes was an amazing researcher. Among other things, K-rations, you know, are for mm-hmm. Ansel Keyes, and he did the famous Minnesota experiment on starvation and its ramifications, and still used today to look at the terrible effects of some of these diets, in fact. Ansel Keyes and his wife spent a lot of time in the Mediterranean and were the to write the Mediterranean diet books. They tied the diet into very low cholesterol. They found a very low incidence of heart disease in the places that they went, Italy and Greece and so forth, where people were following these diets. Ansel Keyes was the first guy to do all of that research into cholesterol, and you know, some of it has turned out to be right. Some of it, of course, has been elaborated upon since he first did it. But he was the first to make that link between cholesterol, saturated mm-hmm. fats, and heart disease in America. The Mediterranean diet, absolutely. It would be a wonderful way to live and to eat. But, you know, again, the Keys, Ansel and Margaret, had such respect for their food. And way before, we think locavore, and this is a new movement, but of course it's not. And there were people in the 50s, in fact, there were people in the 1850s, let alone in the 1950s, but who said eat whole foods, eat local foods, respect the food on your plate. And that's a big part of the Mediterranean diet, too. And I certainly agree that that's far more, you know, rather than worrying about portion and worrying about counting calories and, for goodness sake, worrying about how many carbohydrates or, you know, fats or whatever you have, just respecting food and having lots of wonderful fresh vegetables and fruits and whole grains and small amounts of lean meat or fish or poultry, and don't drink sweetened soda, taxed or not, just don't drink it, you know, you're going to be fine. And have a nice glass of wine with dinner, and have dinner with a friend or with your spouse or with your family. So for a few reasons, one is, as you said with Dean Ornish, so much of it is just enjoying your meals in that way as well, but also you eat more slowly. You know, you eat with a bunch of people, you're talking, you eat slower. When you eat slower, not only do you eat less, but your brain, it takes time for your brain to register that you're full. So the more slowly you eat, the more likely you are not to overeat.
So I would summarize the way you're describing to eat as mindful, respectful, and leisurely.
Yeah, I would say so. And you started this conversation, Michael, and very, very well, I may add, at the beginning when you spoke of those cultures and those people who live to be 100. Mm-hmm. There's been a number of studies about cultures like Okinawa and Sardinia, places where it's the norm to live to be 100. And they find a bunch of different factors going on in these cultures. One is, yes, the food is respected. And in these cultures, they do tend to have lots of fresh vegetables and small amounts of protein, of the animal proteins. But in addition to that, they tend to have great respect for their elders.
Mm-hmm.
Older people are really revered and listened to. And in addition to which, older people remain useful. And they're long-lived. I mean, my father-in-law is 92 years old today. It's his birthday, and he's coming over. In fact, we're having a dinner for him this evening. But he is, as my uncle is a psychoanalyst, he is a psychoanalyst as well, and still sees patients and still leads a very productive life. You know, he doesn't have a concept of he shouldn't be leading a productive life. And that's the way the people in Okinawa and Sardinia and the countries where people are very, very long-lived. And, of course, he's also very mindful of his diet. That's why he said, you know, I'd rather have you cook me, you know, one of your healthy meals than go out to a restaurant, you know, if you don't mind, if it's okay with you. So it's all of these things, and family, and friends, you know, it's all tied in together.
So a total lifestyle. We're talking with Susan Yeager, author of The 100-Year Diet. The website is thehundredyeardiet.com. And it's a both informative and entertaining book, primarily for the layman, although professionals will find it very interesting and helpful as well. Susan, I appreciate you sharing all your research with us, and well done.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
Commentary. As Simon and Garfunkel sang, still crazy after all these years. The 100-year diet helps us see the forest instead of just the trees. The key points from the more than 100 years of diet insanity are, 1, we have a long history of diet gurus, some of whom are legitimate, but many of whom have dubious credentials, seize a pressing social fear, find a small, poorly designed, unreplicated study, and tout it as proof of the efficacy of their diet, and propagate unhealthy eating, and possibly a bestseller. 2, in the 1980s, the American food supply radically changed with increased emphasis on corn, soybeans, wheat, and corn syrup, not to mention trans fat and junk food. That radically changed the healthiness of our food supply. 3, the key to healthy eating and to weight loss is choosing quality foods, being mindful or respectful of what we eat, and leisurely dining rather than grabbing a bite. And 4, for those who don't choose a diet like Dean Ornish's or Robert Pritkin's, a Mediterranean-style diet is one of the better choices. The book, The 100-Year Diet, is fascinating. It's very readable, it gets you thinking, and it gives you perspective. You are listening to Ageless Lifestyles on webtalkradio.net and permanently archived on agelesslifestyles.com. For information on my books, Defy Aging and 52 Baby Steps to Grow Young, my anti-aging hypnosis CDs, personal coaching, and my keynote and seminar services, just go to notaging.com or to drbricky.com, drbricky.com. I'd love to hear your comments and suggestions. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. This is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier. And oh, a reminder, to get your 10% discount on Dr. Sears' Omega RX fish oil and his books and other supplements and products, just go to zonediet.com and use the promotional code AGELESS. That's zonediet.com or call 1-800-404-8171 and use the promotional code AGELESS.